Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. How is everybody doing this week? Thanks for choosing this podcast. If you listened to last week's, Nicholas Holt was fantastic, went viral. And maybe some of you were like, hey, I'll give this podcast a shot now. I really appreciate all your help. I really appreciate all my patrons. Go to patreon.com/insideofyou. If you want to support the podcast and give back and keep this sucker going. Without my patrons, couldn't do it. And we try to have really good conversations here. Here's Ryan Tejas.
Hi.
He's dropping things.
I'm dropping things.
Yeah. It was. We were tired the day we got in here, but we had some caffeine and we're a little bit more jovial. Yeah. What's the word? Exuberant?
Exuberant with it.
I wouldn't say we're exuberant. That's overwhelming with joy.
We're awake.
Yes, we're awake, folks.
Even though that didn't sound very awake. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. It's rainy here in Los Angeles, at least when we recorded this, it was. Go to at Inside of You Podcast on Instagram and Facebook to follow us. Also on the Twitter, it's at Inside of You Pod. And if you go to my Instagram, hopefully you're following me at the Michael Rosenbaum, you can go on my link tree. And on that link tree shows you the cons that Tom Welling and I will be at doing Smallville Nights and whatnot, Cameo. Also, I got to promote, I haven't been promoting it enough, but my new product's called Rosie's Puppy Fresh Breath. Gives your dog better breath and it really works. And you can get it on Amazon. Rosie's Puppy Fresh Breath. It's odorless. It's tasteless. You just put it in your dog's water and the rest is history. Rosie's Puppy Fresh Breath. You could write a review and that really would help.
Odorless and tasteless, much like my personality.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're not so odorless, buddy. I'll tell you that much.
Hey-o.
If you want to go to the Inside of You online store, that's also on the link tree on my Instagram for cool stuff like Lexmas scripts and Smallville ship keys autographed and pictures and tumblers and whatnot. And of course, join Patreon, patreon.com/insideofyou. We got a great guest today. This guy is a legend. He came to the house. He was so awesome. He signed my Indiana Jones action figure or whatever, this statue. And can you see it? Should I move it over a little bit? There it is. You can kind of see it. But he was so sweet. He was so sweet to you, Ryan.
He was really nice. Just a lovely man.
A lovely man and a great voice, the deep voice, and so jovial and fun. And I love John Rhys-Davies. It was really amazing to have him at the house, and you could tell he has so much fun with life. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just all about living. I think that's when you get to a certain age, you're like, you know, just do it, just live. And so that's what he does. And this podcast, I think, is very enlightening. I hope you enjoy it. A lot of good ones coming up, a lot of ones that we just had recorded. So make sure you catch up and I'll see you at a con. Is there anything else I'm forgetting?
No.
So, all right, let's get into it. Let's get into the legendary, amazing, talented, wonderful John Rhys-Davies.
It's my point of view. Listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
This is more than a treat. I said that when I went outside and you were in the car and I was like, this is a treat. It is a treat. It's to me, to many people, you're a legend.
In my own mind.
Do you think that? Do you think, like, do you look back and go, I have a great body of work. I'm proud at what I've done. And you can sit back and say that now?
Yes, I have. But I also would add the caveat, haven't I been lucky?
Really?
Of course. More so in our profession than in any other profession I know.
What is that about luck? They say it's a commodity of preparation and opportunity.
But it's the opportunity. And how many of us never get that opportunity? I went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London. Every single one of my classmates had their moment, their 15 minutes of fame. You know, they got their television series, all except one. I won't mention his name because he's still working. He was unquestionably one of the most able young men that I've ever seen. Plausible, good-looking, athletic. But he never, ever got quite that break.
Really?
Yeah. It's.
And you think he was just as good as you, if not better?
He was different. I got by because, you know, let's face it, if you're tall, fat, and ugly, and you've got a loud voice, you're in a seller's market.
That's not true. You charmer. You're the most charming guy there is.
Oh, I've had my moments.
Yeah, I think you have had your moments. And I look back at, you know, and of course people come to you about all the Indiana Jones movies and Lord of the Rings and Victor Victoria, which is one of the greats. And all these, and Sliders. There's so many people that love Sliders and all these things. But what is the one project that, because a lot of people say, oh, all of them. All of them. I love it all. I just love acting. But what's the one or two that make you smile and go, that was really special to me?
Lord of the Rings has to be a bit special, doesn't it?
I think so.
I've never worked with a sort of virgin crew, for instance. I mean, they'd all done a little bit, but they were so fresh and so keen, and they never worked on a really big project before. And Peter Jackson had created an entire film industry to service his vision of Lord of the Rings. A wonderful cast. And of course, PJ himself.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily capable man. I went with duplicity in my heart, to be honest with you. When I heard that they were making Lord of the Rings, I said, oh yeah, good luck. and who's making it? Peter Jackson. Oh, he's made one or two wonderful small little movies. But, you know, let's face it, if you've got a cast of four and 6 weeks to do it, anyone can direct a movie. And sadly do. You know, but has he any idea of what he's really letting himself in for? I mean, you know, Lord of the Rings has 21 leading parts. It has literally extras numbering, going into the thousands. By the time you've got the army involved on horseback, and we actually one day worked out, I think, that in New Zealand, anyone who had a driver's license had some part in making Lord of the Rings. That wasn't strictly true, but I think about 24,000 people altogether. When you put in the post-production and various parts of the world.
Yeah, is that intimidating to you to walk onto a set and see thousands of extras and focuses on you, or the focus on a couple of you, and you have to perform? Did you have nerves? Do you get nervous? Are you hard on yourself? What is that process like?
I've worked with actors at the Royal Shakespeare Company. My old friend Julian Glover, when we were working at Stratford together. Julian would get so nervous, he would have a bucket and throw up in it every night before we went on stage.
Wow.
I don't know how you do it when you're that nervous.
Yeah.
I guess I have been a little nervous, you know, on first nights sometimes. Yes, when I did Victor Victoria, which you were kind enough to mention, I looked around that extraordinary cast and thought, God, if I can hold my own in this, I might just have a chance. I mean, just amazing.
Yeah.
Not really. Oh, talk about nervous. The other night I had the pleasure of being asked to give a little impromptu welcome at a reception for the American Astronomical Association in New Orleans. They had 3,200 astrophysicists from all around the world.
Yeah, they wouldn't ask me to give a speech for that. I don't think. No.
And I was able to say, ladies and gentlemen, let me say that I have played before large audiences before, sometimes an audience of up to 25,000. But I can honestly say that I've never been in a room with potentially 3,200 people, every one of whom I know is smarter than me.
That's a great, you said that.
Of course I
That's a great way to, you know, make everything sort of, you know, break the ice, sort of like.
Exactly.
And then you go into your thing.
Yeah, well, exactly. But, you know.
But you were nervous a little bit.
No.
No.
I was too tired to be nervous. I've been doing a fan convention all day and you know what it's like.
How do you like those?
I love them.
What is, because you didn't always do them, right?
No. I used to avoid them.
Why is that?
Well, the first one I went to, I remember very acutely thinking, I've got to do this to promote this damn show. What the hell am I doing? Yeah.
You could say fuck.
No, not. I wouldn't dream to.
Oh, you don't say that?
No, I wouldn't.
Oh.
That's
not classy.
Oh, well, it's not with a mic on anyway.
Yeah. But you said it. You've used the word.
No, I've used it occasionally, yes.
but not on.
And done it even more. Never mind.
Good for you. I would hope so.
Indeed, yes.
Yes, that's indeed. The life right there. That's part
yes,
of it.
I may be an old man, but I'm. I like to think of myself as still fully functional without chemical assistance.
Is that true?
Absolutely.
You don't need any Cialis or anything.
Do you know, Cialis is worth taking, particularly if you're getting up there and want to avoid prostate problems.
Really?
Yeah. Have I not given you my prostate thing? Oh, come on, listen. If men get live long enough, we all die of prostate cancer. That's just the way it is. Most of us will die of other things before we die of prostate cancer.
Yes.
Most forms of prostate cancer are benign. It's benign prostatic enlargement.
Right. And you could beat it if you catch it early.
Well, indeed, if you've got, yes.
Yes.
But more than that, if you take a bit of zinc. Now, somebody told me, and I'm sure, you know, 50 million doctors who are listening into this will say he's wrong. But my understanding is this, that when they do biopsies of cancerous prostates, they find little or no zinc in them, which I am told is rather odd because the highest concentration of zinc in the human body is found in the prostate. That would indicate that perhaps a little bit of zinc is called for.
So you take zinc?
I take a little bit of zinc.
But you've never taken a Cialis.
Of course I've taken a Cialis.
Oh, thank God. I was like, you're 79, I'm 51, I'm still taking it. I take it every once in a while.
Very good for you, too.
It's good for me.
I think it probably is good for you because...
Good for the confidence.
Well, but more than that, I think the older you get, and unless you're in very delightful company, the old member gets used less and less, and this is a very bad thing.
Yes,
because obviously, it's like all those ducted type glands, like that thing that in your stomach that squirts an acid in when you have fat in your diet. You know, it's all those things that go like that to release something suddenly. I'll use it or lose it, or use it or block it up. And
right.
And lack of use it contributes, I think, to.
You know, my doctor said that. He said something like, you know, how often do you, not that we're going to get into this, but how often do you, you know, do handle yourself? And I said, not really that much, you know. How much should I? He goes, you should, you know, at least a couple of times a week. And I go, oh, I don't do that at all. And that makes me worry that, like, you need to release. A man needs to release, I guess.
Yes, but you know, there's something sort of rather sordid and grubby about a 79-year-old man bashing the bishop. You know, I feel
genius.
You know, I do not consider myself in any way prudish. In fact, I consider myself a libertine, to be honest. But you know, come on, do I really see myself as the old man engaged in solitary practices?
Yeah. You know. Right. Not for you, but just in general. It's just like I'd rather have a partner.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. It's not that. I have ADD too. So I just get all scattered. I'll fall asleep while trying to do it. You have to, with a voice like yours, and I know you've done things from audiobooks and everything, like reading the Bible and crazy stuff, like intense stuff. But do you do impressions at all?
Not as well as Tony Hopkins does.
He does. I've heard him do some.
Tony does the best impressions of people that you've ever heard.
He does.
He could genuinely phone you up and say, Winston Churchill, I've heard your podcast and that is significant and profound. But you are, young man, in the greatest danger of subverting Western civilization by your profundities, your profanities, perhaps.
Can you do an impression of Anthony Hopkins?
No, I couldn't. What? Tony is... Tony... I can't do Tony as well as
but
Tony does.
But you started to by trying to. You were like the way his mouth is.
Oh, yes, indeed. It's the shape of the mouth that actually much to... And Burton used to get the old... You know the lips going and the megaphone going and oh God, Elizabeth,
you have to be able to do a Sean Connery with that.
Well, I can't quite get lisp,
but you have that voice where if you worked on it, you could easily do that.
Sean is was the ultimate alpha male.
You got to hang out with him.
We did Last Crusade, and I did a...
Oh, yeah, of course, Last Crusade, right.
And I did a piece of crap called... What was it called? Can't even remember.
That was a piece of crap.
It'll come back.
Right.
Anyway, he flew in from Switzerland to the castle where we were filming, and he flew in on Monday from his boat hole in Monte Carlo or Monaco or something like that. Flew in by helicopter, worked Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, flew out... with $1 million in cash, which is a wonderful way of doing things, isn't it?
Really? Wow.
Lovely.
Was he a joy to be around? Or was he difficult? Was he intense? You're watching your words.
I am.
That's okay.
I think he and Michael Caine were the great English-British stars of their generation. And I worked with Caine... I worked on one of Caine's pictures, never actually worked with him. I got blown up before the main titles. It was my first movie.
Great.
But Connery was... an extraordinary man. But one always sensed that... There was a toughness there that never actually relaxed, really.
Wow.
Mind you, when those eyes crinkled quietly in a smile and those sort of slightly purple, mean lips just pursed themselves in a smile, you could just see women going, oh, Sean.
Wow.
But he had, he was the true alpha, the I think the strongest alpha that I've ever met, really.
Intimidating?
No, just 100% male, you know?
Wow. You can feel it. You can see it.
Yeah.
You can sense it.
Yes.
The movie you're thinking of now.
No. I'm thinking of the other alpha would be Bob Mitchum.
Robert Mitchum. You could tell. Yeah. Intense. Yeah.
Bob, you know, at the age of 70-odd, ramrod straight, standing in the middle of the room, surrounded by some of the most beautiful women in Hollywood, and his wife sitting on the sofa glowering at him. Mitch had that.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
When was the last time you auditioned for something?
Oh, God. If I had to depend on auditions, forget it. I'm hopeless at auditions.
Not good at auditions?
No, I'm really bad.
Do you not prepare enough because you're like, I don't want to do this all for nothing?
No. It's not that. It's just that I'm just not very good because an audition, generally there's somebody reading with you. And real acting is about listening. I often get up in the morning with that wonderful frisson of delight. I'm going to work today. I haven't a clue really quite how I'm going to play this part. Yes, I've worked on it. I've done it this way and that way and this way. But I haven't made any real hard and fast decisions. Unless, of course, I am the leading actor.
Right.
And then you really do have to have an idea of what you're going to be doing. But so often with character actors, you know, you're there to make them, the director and the writer, look good.
Yeah.
And also to make yourself look good, of course.
Yeah.
But, you know, until you actually get in the situation and the line comes at you, that's when you know how you're going to play it.
Yeah. I always say that. Just like you said, listen, it's just those moments where I'm not in it, I can't get it, I'm not feeling it, it's because I'm not connected and I'm not listening.
That's right.
And I've been told by mentors and things on set who are older actors I really respect, Tony Award winners, and like, Michael, are you listening? And I go, fuck, I'm not. Let's do it again. I know what I'm doing now. Because everything else, it's just listen and everything else will come. But like with your auditioning, like, did you audition for Lord of the Rings?
Well, I did hear that they were doing it, and I got asked to put something on tape. And I thought, Lord of the Rings? Ah, yes, well, this is going to be a complete a cluster, whatever it is. I thought, never mind, I haven't been to New Zealand. Go there, take a part for a month, look around, and walk away because this is never going to happen. You know, this is never going to happen. He has no idea what happens when you make a big movie, you know, and I've done some big ones. I mean, Shogun in Japan.
Yep.
We were meant to spend 3 weeks in Tokyo in the tanks doing the sequence. We spent eight.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
But you put yourself on tape for Lord of the Rings.
I put myself on tape because I wanted to, I think I wanted to play John Noble's part. I thought, you know, get in, month's work, see the country, get paid, go home. And then when they came back and said, we want you for Gimli, I thought, what the hell? I've spent 30 years trying to be recognized. What the heck would I be? Why would I want to put myself in a prosthetic like that? And why would I want to spend 5 or 6 hours a day, you know, in makeup? And I said, no. Oh, don't worry, John, said my marvelous then manager, Louise.
Yeah.
Well, she, you know, we're still friends, but she's really not quite in the business anymore. But
right.
She said, don't worry, they're going to get it down to an hour. I said, nonsense. You can't get it down to an hour. You know, it's going to be a full prosthetic. It's going to take 5 to 8 hours out of my filming life. And more than that, it's, you know, who wants to spend 3 years in New Zealand in a film that actually comes out in part one, fails, and then the other two go direct to video or something like that.
You were really optimistic about this.
Absolutely. Absolutely certain. And come on. Do you know the expertise that you need in every department to bring off something like that?
What are the odds that it actually came to be what it was? Wow.
I went there and I thought, come on, because basically I got the scrunch from two people. One, my agent, who is now my current manager, Jeff Goldberg. Wonderful. Jeff said, look, John, I don't think, if you're going to turn down this part, I don't think we can continue to represent you, which I thought was a bit of a
ballsy,
gonad squeeze. Actually, yeah. I thought, yeah.
can you say that one more time? A gonad squeeze.
Well, you said it. So why
don't need to say it again. Okay. I just really liked it.
You went back. I'm trying to be polite because I know you have a very delicate young audience.
No, people love this shit. This is already the best interview I've already. So, yeah.
And my number one son said, Dad, if you turn down this, I think you're nuts. And I said, why? And he said, think about it. In every bookshop around the world, in many languages, and he indicated a size about a foot and a half. And he said, there's that much book space devoted to Tolkien. And I thought, got a point. Went there, thought I'll check it out,
right?
And will confirm my prejudices that this is a no go from a go. And then I'll go to Peter Jackson and say, Peter, I'm terribly sorry. I've got an ill wife. I've got a family. I can't be away from home. And he would have had to let me go. You can't.
You already had an exit strategy.
I had an exit strategy. So I spent the first 2 weeks every morning and every afternoon sitting in a different department just to convince myself that these kids had not an idea. And I slowly got more and more depressed because in every department there was a level of enthusiasm that is found nowhere else in the world. And excellence that you'd only expect to find in the great film capitals of the world. But I still had a way out. What is the director? How does he handle his crew and his cast? So I went and watched Peter directing for a scene or two. He had the answers to everything. He was enthusiastic. His crew loved him. His way of dealing with his cast was marvelous. And I realized, slowly it dawned on me, and then 2 weeks into production, we had a press conference. And everybody was there, Lord of the Rings, in New Zealand, big production. This is going to be another screw up, isn't it? And all that sort of thing. And I am proud to say that I was the first person who got up and said, ladies and gentlemen of the press, revise your expectations upwards. Three predictions. One, this film that we're doing now is going to outgross the new Star Wars, at which point Peter Jackson buries his head in his hands. Two, these films, when they come out, are going to be regarded as the most remarkable and successful films of the decade. And in 20, 25 years' time, when you look back, you will recognize them as being a masterpiece of filmmaking.
Wow. And then your son looked at that video and said, who is this guy? Who is this guy? How did he change so fast? Wow. That is amazing.
And about 18 months later, PJ came to me and he said, when you said that? I said, you mean when you bedded your head in my hands? He said, yes. As a matter of fact, the figures have just come in and we've just outgrossed the new Star Wars.
That is amazing.
Well, you get, I'd done some big ones. I did War and Remembrance, which was 18 months of principal photography around the world. You get the sense of what can go wrong and what does wrong. Shogun, losing that time, but then being able to make it up. in War and Remembrance, we had one of our leading ladies came down with pneumonia. And basically, we had to stop filming for 5-6 weeks. The challenge for a big production like that is not getting behind. The real quality that production coordinators and great producers have is they make it happen no matter what. In those days, there wasn't much accommodation to be had in South Island, New Zealand. We go down to Queenstown to shoot a sequence. We go down there with, you know, the principal actors, the hobbits, basically nine of the Fellowship, and one or two others. We've got 200 crew. We've got 200 horses, Nazgul, extras. So we're down there. And it starts to rain. Now, production office is about 3 kilometers outside Queenstown. It rains. It rains again. To the effect that it actually wipes out 7 or 10 houses on the hillside overlooking the little road into Queenstown, wipes out that road. And we've now got a 19-kilometer single track to get in and out of the center of town. This is the only time in my life that I've ever entered my hotel room via stepladder, because the entire ground floor was underwater. And that famous call sheet went out. There will be no filming tomorrow because the lake is underwater.
The lake.
And the lake, all the lake round
us. Oh, my gosh.
We didn't film that following day. The day after that, we moved to another part of New Zealand. And the day after that, we shot another sequence and finally went back later on. The logistical qualities that you need to do that. Well, you know, if you were in the German army, you know, Rommel would be very happy to have you on his side. Great producers, great production coordinators, making phone calls all the time, talking to lonely farmhouses, saying, can you put up our crew, you know, yeah, 6 members of our crew here. It was
an good analogy, yeah.
Oh, amazing.
That is unbelievable. I know that the whole thing with it, we don't have to talk about it long, but with the tattoos, that everybody got a tattoo, but you were the one that didn't. I know you've talked about it, but you told your stuntman to get a tattoo.
Absolutely. I did what any self-respecting actor would do when faced with a dangerous stunt. I sent the stunt double.
And he did it.
Exactly. He's very proud of it, too.
Do you regret it? If you could go back, would you have gotten the tattoo?
Screw thee, no.
Do you have any tattoos?
Good Lord, no. No, I'm not a tattoo man.
You're not a tattoo man?
No, I don't like needles to begin with. But more than that, it seems to be a generational thing. I'm of a generation that actually respects two sorts of tattoos, really. One, serving military people, you know, it's part of that bonding thing that you have, you know, with your regiment, with your naval colleagues or your Air Force colleagues.
Yes.
And of course, there are tribes, the Maori, for instance, have tattoos. That tattooed beard on a woman's face means that she is royally descended. And these tattoos, you know, have
symbolism.
Yeah, they have cultural value and significance.
Yeah, I understand that.
If you and I had a tattoo for every film we'd done, we'd look like the Illustrated Man, wouldn't we?
And it seemed pretentious if it was every film. Oh, this is from Shogun. Oh, this is from, yeah, that would look a little bit much. I have very little ones because I'm a wimp, but right. I have my sister who passed away and I have my grandmother's and that's it.
Well, that's...
that's it. Just yeah. Little ones.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Is this a true story? when everybody did everybody were you there on Raiders of the Lost Ark when everybody got food poisoning, everybody had diarrhea, and they were filming? Is that a true story? And they couldn't film it, and so you know, Harrison Ford, the thing where
you've got me for 3 hours, Stephen. It's a three-day shoot. It's stupid scene anyway. He'd just take his gun out and shoot him. Show me. Roll camera. And cut. 3 pages out of the script. Yep, that's true.
That's true.
Oh, yes, it's true.
And you were sick?
Oh, dear me. I lost 22 pounds.
The whole crew?
Not, I don't know about them.
I don't care about them.
All I know is that when Stephen, there was a sequence where I'm going to be shot by the German cook, and he takes me out, and we did a sequence, and we're going to, I think we shot it. Anyway, Stephen said, "John, can you bend down to give him a better eye line?" And as I did so, I filled my jalaba in front of 200 people, and I didn't care. You've heard of tunnel vision?
Oh, yeah. I've had that.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
It literally
is like...
Words were coming down a cone, you know, down to you and entering your head. And the vision is really very, very tight. It's about 6 inches wide. My next memory is I'm lying into this hotel bed. Unfortunately, it's the hotel room where no matter where I put the damn bed, that little column of ants would come in and walk over my chest and exit down somewhere. So I'm lying in this bed with ants in it.
Oh, God.
In which I have vomited and excreted. I have a temperature of around about 105. I'm dying. I am dying. It's probably of dysentery or diphtheria. I don't know, something like
God.
That. And I hear the key go in the lock. And the little flame of life begins to pick up as the door opens. And in comes our wonderful Australian lady doctor. And she doubles over and she says, "Oh, Christ, John, I see you've got it too. Can I use your toilet?" God died at that moment. I knew there was no hope. I knew. I gave up my soul. I commended my soul.
Did you think you were going to die? That's how bad you felt? I'm going to die during this
movie. I wanted to die. Anyway, massive rehydration and some, you know, one gets better. I lost 22 pounds in 2 days.
That's...
If you lose 10% of your body weight, the kidneys collapse and you have irreversible organ damage. Fortunately, I was a big lad. I was about 240, 250 pounds. So I didn't quite get into that. But my guts were never really the same after that.
Oh, my God. And supposedly Spielberg didn't get sick because he was eating out of a can. He didn't eat the food that everybody got poisoned with.
Well, far be it from me to betray a man that I love and adore. But that son of a bitch turned up with 2 suitcases of tinned food from Harrods. And he only ate that. Well, he got to, you know, the director's got to be there.
Yes.
He's got to be on the set. And he would occasionally, his conscience would occasionally prick him. And he would come down and sit with us at the table and he would order a piece of lamb overcooked, and he would carefully pick it apart.
Oh my God.
And toy with it on the thing and then put his fork down and talk a bit and this sort of thing. And then he would pick it apart. You know, he didn't actually touch the damn stuff at all. I don't blame him. Oh, dear me. It was a really tough one, that.
And Harrison got sick too?
Harrison got sick too. Frankly, I think...
Most of the crew.
All of us came down with something. I mean, it was a really... Look, we were shooting in September, in the last oasis before the really true Sahara begins. September is the time of the date harvest. When the dates are out, the flies are everywhere. Added to which, we had 5,000 or 6,000 Arab extras, and we clearly didn't have enough latrines. So after 5 weeks of shooting there, you sat down in the desert and put your hand in the sand and, yeah, yes.
I've done that on the beach once.
Yeah.
That's what I understand.
Yeah. Anyway, the flies were everywhere.
This was not a great experience filming, you're saying that.
It was one of the toughest.
One of the toughest.
Yeah.
Do you still, by the way, obviously, I'm sure you don't call them all the time, but like Harrison or Steven, I mean, is there some people you talk to here and there?
Well, Harrison and I don't really have a great deal in common, and I, you know, I work around the world, so I'm seldom in Hollywood. But every time I used to bump into Stephen, I used to say to him, "Stephen, now look, 1 and 3, wonderful. 2 and 4, not quite there, isn't it? Now, what is there missing in 2 and 4 that there was in 1 and 3?"
The proverbial you. That's amazing. I'm sure he gets a kick out of that. What a treat. I mean, you've been in some of the two biggest franchises ever.
Well,
I mean, nobody who can say that. Not many people.
I've done a Bond film too.
Again, a Bond film with Timothy Dalton.
That's right.
How much fun was that?
A lot of fun.
Did you like him? Is he a good person?
Timmy and I had butted heads in the theater in 1969, in my first little pro job in as an actor after having left RADA, and we got on fabulously well after that. I think Timmy was a superb Bond.
Yeah.
But then Pierce, well, I think, did a damn good job as Bond as well.
I remember just Roger Moore from when I was younger.
Roger, I met Roger. I knew Roger, yes.
You did?
Yeah, he was pretty good. But for me, Connery.
Yeah, it's everybody's.
Connery was, there was a meanness about Connery, you know. Mm. You know, this was a guy you could imagine would actually kill.
Yeah. He might have. He might have killed. Who knows?
No.
I'm sure he's getting a lot of fights.
Well, he was a fighter. He was a boxer. He had done a bit of boxing, you know, and as a younger man.
Yeah. Hey, did you ever improvise on sets? Were you someone that Spielberg would say, just do something, just, you know, do, you know, if feel free? Do you like that?
I personally love that. Many actors hate that. They want the security of the words there in the framework that's there. That's what they know. I loved working with Peter, for instance, because we'd get what we needed to do for the scene. And then he said, okay, I'm cutting it loose now.
Wow.
Vamp a bit. And every time he giggled, I knew it would at least be in the first cut.
Was there anything that you can recall when watching the movies, you're like, I added that?
Well, not the beard was added because I was doing a funny balancing thing like that. And Orlando thought I was actually losing my balance. So he put his arm out instinctively to help me and grabbed the beard. And I grabbed his hand and said, not the beard. And Peter left it in. There were one or two others, but but sometimes these things just evolve, you know?
Yeah. You know, I hear all these stories, these amazing stories. And I always say, we were just talking to another guest about how life is about memories. Life is about the good times, your family, your friends. And that's really what you take with you. I mean, you know, you can't take
all you leave behind. Really.
You leave behind. Right. Yeah, yeah.
All you leave behind are your children and the memories.
Right.
And that's why it's important for us actors to bear in mind that that is all we leave behind. I was talking to a group of young American actors about a year ago, and I mentioned Laurence Olivier. Laurence Olivier, the greatest stage actor in Britain in the 20th century, most famous.
Hopkins does a great impression of him too, by the way.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
And I don't, this, whatever, I don't know what he says, but it's brilliant, yeah.
I saw blank looks in their eyes, and I said, Sir Laurence Olivier? Who knows who Sir Laurence Olivier was? And one put his hand up and he said, was he a writer? And I thought, oh God, if the most famous stage actor of the 20th century is forgotten already, none of us have got a chance.
It tells you what's important, shows you what's important.
The way actors must conduct themselves, really, by the end of their lives, and you never know when that's going to happen, is that when you die, you know, your colleagues, your friends say, gosh, I knew him. He was a good guy. I missed him. I cried when Robin Williams died.
Yeah, me too.
There was an indefinable greatness about Robin that just touched your heart.
And a lot, there was a feeling I got of just, you just knew he was a good man. Like he had a big heart and he cared and he loved and he probably cared so much about making people happy and being great and all those things that weigh on you. And he was one of those people I imagine did it more for others than himself, took care of others more than he did himself.
I think good actors do. I think good actors actually care for each other on the stage. I mean, you can take care of each other in a different way. I mean, the great thing about working at Stratford was there would always be at least five or six hungry actors on the stage, you know, and you'd go on and you'd go out on and you'd pick a quarrel. You know, you'd stand in a slightly different blocking position and blast the guy next to you with a line. And he would go, he would flinch and look around and he'd hit the next person with the next line. And, you know, and suddenly you'd feel the audience leaning forward and the temperature in the theater dropping as these great, dangerous, powerful lords squabbled over the bones of England. It was wonderful.
Wow.
And you get off and you hug each other. You
know? I have this visual. He's just telling that story. I'm actually thinking of the audience. I'm seeing them as you guys are on stage and just, ah, man, that's beautiful. What is the hardest time of your life, if you could look back? If it was the toughest time, and how did you get through it?
Hardest thing of all, I lost a son here in Los Angeles, actually. Born on the 22nd, died on the 27th. The loss of a child is something that no parent wants to hear about. Those who have lost children are a special group of humanity, and only we can talk to each other. Normal parents don't want to hear about the loss of a child because it might be catching. And that's how instinctive we are as human animals. There is no pain like that. I will not be the only parent who will say that in these circumstances you ask the questions as delicately and objectively as you can to see if there's any part of you that can save this child's life, and you would quite happily. I would have been very happy to go into Cedar Sinai and say, look, I'm very sorry about this. There's a child who can use my heart in such and such a room. I beg your pardon. I'm going to the bathroom now. Bang. Clear up the mess and use it. Because that's what parents do.
You know, my father, a couple years ago, we lost my sister, and very old school, never saw him with any emotions except, you know, anger or, you know, laughing at times. But never, he wasn't one of those, I love you, I'm proud of you, all these things. And when my sister was sick for a very long time, but the phone call I got, I'll never forget his voice and him, the grief that I felt through him.
Yes.
And the crying is just like a pain that I never want to imagine again. I know, I'm sure, God forbid, but I will probably, you know, I'll go through those moments, but like, it was life changing. It was life changing for me. It was obviously life changing for him, but yeah, I can't imagine that. It's like, and the follow-up question is, you know, you say, how do you go on? And you say, well, what else is there to do?
Well, You go on because you have other children. And you go on because there's work to be done. And I really do believe in the discipline of the theater. The show must go on. It doesn't matter about your misery, your anguish, your pain. The show goes on, and you do it. And of course, work is a great doctor. But the let me take advantage of this this segue that you introduced here. Look, I'm 80 years old. I tell my three children. I'm now 80 years old. The hammer will fall one day. I do not believe it will be today, but I don't know. From now on, every time you say goodbye to me with the sense that it might be the last time you say goodbye to me, and I will be doing that to you too.
Wow.
But more than that, don't worry about death. You know, Seneca says, look, you should rehearse your death. In your mind, you should rehearse your death so that you get over the fear of it. I've had a plane crash. I had a plane crash in Zimbabwe in 85. And, you know, as the plane was crashing, you know, I learned something about myself. I am not going to be one of those people who goes, oh, my God, I'm going to die. For me, it was, oh, shit. What a stupid, stupid way to end. It was like a great blanket of depression. And I've had guns pointed at me, and once or twice I've thought, oh, dear, this is not going to be a happy end. And the other night, actually, I was driving over the mountain, and I skidded on the wet road, and I went into the blackness, and I thought, oh, God, this is going to hurt. I don't know why. I just picked the right spot, and the blackness was actually another bit of road just coming into it a little bit lower. Got away with it. But don't be afraid of death. Every one of us is going to die. You know, be afraid of pain. I mean, I don't want to...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I will whimper if I've got tubes up everywhere and, yeah. You know, and the pain can't be... So, but don't be afraid of it. I lack real faith. Many of my Christian friends, many of my non-Christian friends, have a belief in a life after death. I used to have no belief in a life after death, but I think the nature of the universe, and the more we know about it, means the less we know. You know, people say there isn't a God. Well, if you can believe in Boltzmann's brains, for instance, the idea that from quantum froth, an entire Volkswagen bus can burst into reality and vanish equally quickly. Well, a brain could do that as well and vanish, or a brain might manage to establish itself in that billionth of a trillionth of a split second. That would be, if you can believe that.
Like a transcending.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, if you've got enough space and enough time, anything can happen.
That's a good way to think.
And what do we got? We've got 400, is that, let me get right, 400 or 400 billion stars in our galaxy.
A lot.
There are 200 to 400 billion galaxies in our universe. If the multi-universe theory is true, we've got, well, the first number I saw was 10 to the 500th power. The last one I saw was 10 to the 1,000th power to the 10,000th power. I mean, that's a lot of universes, that's a lot of space and a lot of time. We know nothing. And indeed, some physicists are saying that there is, in fact, a determinism in the universe. I mean, I think that the suggestion that under the randomness of the quantum event, there is a determinist, a hard determinist physics, or I don't know, we call it physics. I mean, there was that chap the other day who says there's biological evidence of determinism anyway. In other words, if I was to get up now and walk out of this room, your brain, before I'd even made up my mind to get up and walk out of this room, your mind is already preparing itself for that event. I'm a bit skeptical about that, but, you know.
It's a possibility. It's always a possibility. And you have to realize the possibilities that surround you.
That's right.
And even if it's the slight probability.
Yes.
I think that I like to think like that. I like my grandmother. You know, I have a lot of atheists or agnostics around the family. And I like to say, I look at her and I go, we're going to be all right. After it ends, you're going to see Grandpa again. It's all good. And he goes, I think so too, Mikey. And I'm like, good. You think that.
Yes.
Why the hell should you? Anyway. All right. This is last. This is called Shit Talking. By the way, Reese. John Reese. Davis.
John Reese. John Davis.
Davis. Davis.
The Welsh name, you see. Welsh.
This is Shit Talking with John Reese Davis.
All right.
Rapid fire.
Oh God, one of those. Why can't we talk about NASA? NASA is doing the most important. it's doing the most important engineering in the world.
You belonged giving that speech to those astrophysicists.
Oh, you were
made for that.
Yeah.
Gen T, when reading scripts, what are the two things within the writing that need to stand out for you before you decide to take the role?
Do I believe it? Do I believe these characters? Oh, you take parts for any number of reasons, don't you, really? I mean, because a friend asks you to do it.
Not anymore, though. I decided no more friend things.
No more friend things?
No. Not unless it's unbelievable. Because usually it's like, all right, dude, I'll do it.
Well, you know, yeah, sometimes you're owed a favor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you didn't ask me, what about my scripts? Now, listen, I am just putting together a little studio in the Isle of Man. And when I get that done, which I hope is going to be finished in end of May, June, I am going to go out and shake the money tree to get the money to make the movies I want to make, which celebrate the human soul and how glorious mankind is.
And wow.
That's what we want to make.
What I love that you still have such a passion. Such like, you know, you're like, this is what I love. This is what I do. And I want to create and I want to tell stories. And that doesn't end, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. I've been in the business now, nearly 50 years. And my apprenticeship is almost over. Now to get on to the serious stuff.
I love that. When can we expect that? Is that just it's a work in progress?
Well, no, I've got the scripts and I've got a little studio now. But I really need to raise some money. You know, the damnable thing is, look what Hollywood's doing at the moment. With all due respect, and I love some of the actors involved in it, remaking Shogun. What we have is such a creative vacuum here.
Yeah,
people who have no ideas, and you know. And the truth of the matter is many actors have ideas. But because we don't want actors to have ideas.
Yeah. So we'll give it to the marketing guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
The marketing guys have, can this make money? No, forget it. It's a great story. No, forget it. It's not going to make money. That's how it goes.
Is it a sequence? Is it a series? Can we have trilogies?
Yeah.
I remember talking to Bob Shea. He said, we got another trilogy. And it was the Philip Pullman one, you know, Dark Matters and things like that. And he told me, and I laughed, and I said, not a chance. He said, what do you mean, not a chance? He was deeply offended. It's a trilogy. The very fact that you have a trilogy means that you've got a bucket full of overflowing money that's going to happen to you. And I said, think about it. Pullman was a teacher of English in schools. He taught Milton. He hated teaching Milton, so he reversed the whole thing. Instead of God's the bad guy expelling Satan, and it's really those immortals that the real story is about. I said, you do that. Essentially, You completely alienated all the Abrahamic faith, faiths, you know, Christians, Muslims, Catholics, Protestants, Jews.
You should run a studio.
I couldn't do worse than some of these lads.
No,
are doing.
I think people should listen to you. All right, look, I don't need to ask any more questions. This has been so good. This is probably one of my favorite interviews of all time. I'm not kidding. I had over 300 interviews. Ryan, would you say this is just fucking freaking great? You're so awesome.
My mother used to say that.
Well, my mother never said that to me. So I'm glad to hear it from you. I wish you all the best. I looked in your IMDb and it says in production. You're doing projects now that are coming out, right?
Well, I hope so, yes.
Anything that you could say?
What the heck is... I'll tell you what, I'm writing a script for a friend of mine that I think is really good and commercial. I think I've just about got an option on somebody else's marvelous, funny Paris in the 50s and 60s script. Howlingly funny and quite obscene.
Good.
Roger Christian's project is, I hope, going to be made this year. Dark Angel. Roger won his Oscar, I think, for the first Star Wars. He made a short called Dark Angel, which has now morphed into something else, which has now morphed into a miniseries. And for the past 20-odd years, every day, every sort of autumn I've had, we're definitely going in the spring. And so we're doing that. There's two or three little movies, I think. Hey, who knows? Who knows?
You are just prolific. You're quite prolific.
As we used to say at Stratford, art for art's sake and money for Christ's sake.
This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
I hope you'll come back sometime.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Of course.
I mean, he signed my Indiana Jones figure. He took pictures with you guys. He hung out for a while.
Talked about Cialis.
I mean, who does that? Only legends can talk about Cialis with such conviction.
But it's just the accent and the voice. And
well, of course. Well. It's actually good for you. Cialis should pay me for this podcast.
They should. He should be a sponsor. How great would that be?
Make sure you take Cialis every morning. That sounds like Sean Connery, didn't it?
It was a little bit.
If it lasts for more than 4 hours, please seek medical attention.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what it is, but it's been harder for me to wake up these last few days. I don't know if it's the weather or
post surgery. The weather doesn't help.
The weather,
especially here, especially when it's nice for a couple of days and then it just torrential downpour.
Is it normal to be a little depressed on a rainy day?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Ask someone from Seattle. Ask your buddy Joel McHale.
Yeah, he seems like he's never depressed.
Feel like he had to counter that. I think like if you grow up in it, you probably find ways around it.
Yeah.
But if it just hits really hard, just all of a sudden, just after a lovely springish day, which I think is why today was especially depressing.
Mm. Yes. Also, I'm very excited, by the way. My book, I did a children's book and it comes out like probably August, September. And we're getting to the nitty gritty. We're getting to the end. And it's really good. I showed, they sent me a mock-up.
I've seen it.
So and it's pretty cool, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I can't say much about it now, but it's going to be, it's a great gift. It's a great tabletop kind of talking point. I'm really proud of it. I think it's going to be just fantastic. And Simon & Schuster is putting it out. And a lot of people have asked me about the John Heder show, Scared, that where John and I go across the world and find the scariest places on earth. We're still trying to shoot that scheduling. So hopefully we'll shoot them this year and those will hopefully air. And I'll let you know about that. Well, hey, we appreciate you listening today. We hope you had a good time and we'll continue to try to get great guests and hopefully you guys could continue to support the podcast. And if you're able to, go to patreon.com/insideofyou and become a patron and support the podcast. There's tons of perks and things that I send my top tier patrons and they get their names shouted out every episode. So check it out if you'd like. Right now, and also Instagram. Go to my link tree for all the great things that are going on. Right now, we're going to do the top tier shout out. You ready, Ryan?
I'm ready.
Nancy D, Leah S. Nancy D, Leah, and Kristen. I hope, Leah, you're doing very well. I know you were struggling a little bit, and I'm thinking about you. Little Lisa, enough with the gifts. I don't need any more gifts from you. You're too kind. Save your money. Buy yourself something nice. Yukiko, we love you. Jill E. Brian Hinnenkamp. Nico P. I won't even try to pronounce your last name because, Nico, I mess it up. Hey, Zach. Robert B. Brandenburg. Jason Dreamweaver. Sophie M. From Australia. That wasn't a good, that was an English accent. Raj C. Jennifer N. Stacy L. Jamal F.
Janelle B, Mike E, Eldon Supremo, 99 more, Santiago M, Leanne P, Maddie S, Belinda N, Dave H,
Dave Hall,
Brad D, Ray H, Tabitha T, Tom N, Talia M, Betsy D, Rhiannon C, Corey K, Dev Nixon, and Michelle A.
By the way, Santiago M, thanks to you again for helping me make that figure for John Glover. He called me in tears. Hold on, I'm going to play John's message.
Oh, really? I saw the picture. That was neat.
It was,
that was very cool.
He is such, this is after he got the statue that Tom Welling and I got him that Santi had made.
I want to leave a message. I'm looking at myself, this big, beautiful thing that just arrived. Michael, where does it come from? Who did it? Where is it? Why? Do you have one of you? Okay. All right.
He was just so excited. He didn't know what to say. He's such a beautiful man.
Do
I love
have
him.
One of you?
I do. It's right there. Santi made that as well. Jeremy C, Mr. M, Eugene, and Leah. How are you guys? How's the baby? Baby's growing up. Mel S, Christine S, Eric H, Shane R, Andrew M, Oracle, Amanda R, Kevin E, Stephanie K, Jammin' J, Leanne J, Luna R, Mike F, Stonehenge. I just sent you a package, Stonehenge. Brian L, Jules M, Jessica B, Kaylee J.
Brian A, Marion Louise L, Frank B, Jen T, April R M, Randy S, Oral Oral P, Rachel D,
Melissa, Oral B,
Melissa H, Nick W, Stephanie and Evan, Charlene A, Don G, Jenny B, John. That Red Bull is kicking in.
Jennifer R, Tina E, Angie, Tracy, Tasha S, Keith B, Anna M, and Waffles. Oh, I got my wings. Guys, thank you from the bottom of my heart. I love you. You know that. Thanks for listening. 6 years ago, I never would have thought this would have lasted more than 6 days. But here we are, over 300 episodes. And it's because all of you who listened to the end. And support me and support Ryan and support Bryce and support Jason. And big shout out to Jason, my editor. You're incredible. Everything you do, I really appreciate you. And Bryce, who keeps this whole damn shit stacks, shit stack to get smoke show together. Can do it. And of course, Ryan, the L. Ryan Tejas. That's the Ryan Tejas in Espanol. Supremo. If you don't speak Espanol. All right. Thanks. From the Hollywood Hills in Hollywood, California, I am Michael Rosenbaum.
I am L. Ryan Tejas.
Little wave, Ryan. All right. We love you. And please, from the bottom of my heart, be good to yourself. I'll see you next week.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone's senior writer, Brian Hyatt.
Now, here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.